We're here for argument in the case of Far Right Applications of City of Aurora with the opposer appellant Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District and the East Cherry Creek Valley Water and Sanitation District. I want to advise the parties that Justice Hodge is not participating in this case. So we're ready to hear from the appellant.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Doug Steiner, and I am pleased to represent one of the appellants in this case, Northern Colorado Water Conservancy District, or Northern Water for short. The two appellants have agreed to split their argument time equally, so I will be arguing for 15 minutes. I do intend to reserve some portion of my time for rebuttal. As you probably know, Northern Water is a water conservancy district organized in 1937 under the Conservancy Act. The primary purpose of the district was to contract with the United States government for the delivery of up to 310,000 acre feet of water per year from the Colorado River to the South Platte River Basin through the Colorado Big Thompson Project Facilities, or CBT project. The impetus for the project was a series of drought and depression years in the 1930s that made it clear that the people of Northern Colorado needed a substantial supplemental supply of water in order to prosper. Consequently, the people elected to form the district and contract with the United States government for the construction of the CBT project. They obligated themselves to repay one half of the cost of the project, which at the time was estimated to be $25 million, over a period of 40 years. They also elected to have all property included within the district subject to a one mill tax or levy. And that levy has, the assessments from that has provided millions of dollars over the years to fund the project and has allowed Northern Water to actually repay its obligation under the repayment contract. At the time, it was an enormous investment, but over the years, especially during the drought years, it has proved to be very wise and valuable investment as it has delivered well over 200,000 acre feet per year of water into the South Platte Basin. Northern Water is appealing the judge's decision in this case primarily because of the enormous implications it has on Northern Water's ability to control the use of the large amount of return flows resulting from the initial uses of CBT project water in the South Platte River. As this question.
Just a question about large. I thought that Judge Klein found that it was incidental.
Judge Klein seemed to think that the benefit to Aurora was somehow incidental in that the water is already there in the river and Aurora is simply exchanging on it. I would disagree that the amount of CBT return flows is incidental.
Am I wrong? Was there evidence taken on that issue?
All the evidence was based on the stipulated facts.
What were the stipulated facts with respect to that?
Well, I think the judge found that there is benefit to Aurora as a result of being able to use CBT water or the exchange potential created by CBT water in the exchange reach. Now, that's a fact that the water court found. The judge went on to describe that as incidental benefit to Aurora, but I think there's an important distinction there. I don't believe it's incidental. One, it's a very important benefit that Aurora is getting in this case. Okay. As described in the Estes Park decision, CBT project return flows are critical to the organizational and financial operational scheme of the district. Because of transit losses, CBT water cannot be effectively delivered in the South Platte River to many of the downstream users in the lower half of the district. The primary value of the project to the landowners that are included within the district, in the lower half of the district, is CBT project return flows. They bear the same tax burdens as landowners in the upper part of the district, but their benefits are primarily from CBT project return flows, and that's what Northern is seeking to protect in this case. The repayment contract provides a detailed framework whereby the first use of CBT project water is allocated by contract, but then return flows are allocated in accordance with the scheme set forth in Article 19 of the repayment contract. So the specific issue in this case is whether the City of Aurora, an entity located entirely outside the district boundaries who has never paid assessments to Northern Water, may nevertheless use CBT project water that is in the exchange reach. What is at stake generally here for Northern is Northern's ability to control its Trans Mountain water and reserve the benefits of the CBT project for those who have borne the financial burdens of the project, the Northern taxpayers. You must uphold Northern's ability to allocate the benefits of the CBT project for its taxpayers. Otherwise, you will be rewarding the Johnny-come-latelys like Aurora while penalizing those with the foresight and fortitude to have developed and financed and funded the CBT project for the last 70 years. Just a couple of facts I want to emphasize before going to the argument. The exchanges cover a broad reach of the South Platte River from as far down as Milliken up to above the city of Brighton. About two-thirds of that exchange reach, the lower two-thirds, is within the Northern District boundaries and is in a position to receive CBT project water in the form of return flows and direct deliveries of CBT. As I said, the Water Corp found that CBT water in the exchange reach could increase Aurora's exchange potential by making more water available to satisfy the intervening senior water rights in the exchange reach. This is concept is also illustrated in the schematic diagram that is in Northern's reply brief. So getting to the Water Corp ruling. The Water Corp recognized the prohibitions on extra district benefits from CBT project water that are inherent in the Conservancy Act, the repayment contract, and Northern Water's rules, as discussed by this court in the Thornton case. But the Water Corp found that they do not apply to Aurora because Aurora has no allotment contracts with Northern Water. Inherent in this decision is the misunderstanding that Northern's only source of authority to control the use of CBT water is the authority to enforce its allotment contracts. This is the fundamental reason that Northern is appealing the Water Court's decision in this case. The Water Court erred for several reasons. First, even if the Water Court was right that the Thornton decision is based entirely on some form of contractual privity.
Council, can I stop
yes,
you there?
You bet.
Because that's the point I'm interested in. Could you help me understand Thornton, or at least your reading of Thornton, as being beyond some contractual obligation to limit these exchanges?
Yes.
How do you read that decision?
Well, I think this court went to great lengths to analyze all aspects, all applicable authorities. The Water Conservancy Act, they started with the Water Conservancy Act, then went to the repayment contract, then went to Northern Water's rules, and found that they all prohibited the use proposed by Thornton. The two of the main uses that Thornton proposed in that case involved CBT project water allocated to the Water Storage and Supply Company by water allotment contract. Thus, it was logical that the court would analyze that allotment contract in the context of evaluating whether Thornton could use the CBT project water as proposed. But there's another use that Thornton had proposed, and it was of CBT project water return flows that accrued from the North Poudre Irrigation System to Jackson Ditch Company seepage rights. And the court, in a separate section of the Thornton opinion, analyzed Thornton's proposed use of that and found that it was inconsistent with the repayment contract. And again, this is water that's not the subject of any water allotment contract to which Thornton would have been privy to. So I think you have to realize that the court logically looked at the allotment contract in the Thornton case, but when it came time to actually view CBT water seepage and return flows, the holding is based on whether or not it's consistent with the repayment contract. And the court found that it wasn't and prohibited that use. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there seems to be this concept of no harm, no foul, and I do want to address that. Thank you. The fundamental issue really is Northern's ability to control the use of CBT water for the benefit of its district taxpayers in accordance with the manner set forth in the repayment contract. If Northern loses that control, then there is indeed harm. Then those CBT return flows are not being allocated by Northern in accordance with the repayment contract. They're being allocated essentially by Aurora to meet the senior priorities of the water rights in the exchange reach, the intervening water rights. That's one harm. It creates basically diminishes the value of to Northern. The potential.
But what the judge clearly said that they can't have no degree of a right, you have an enforceable right.
Well, Aurora clearly wants to use the CBT water, and whether they claim that right formally or not, I think doesn't matter. If the proposed decree term would simply eliminate Aurora's ability to use CBT project water to satisfy senior intervening water rights in the exchange reach. That's all Northern is proposing. That's all the decree limitation would do.
My question was just a follow-up. Is what would have to happen before Aurora could use that water? I mean, a number of things, isn't that right?
Northern would have to quantify the amount of CBT return flows in the river and provide that information.
Would it not?
I don't know if it'd have to go back to the water court. It would certainly have to provide the information to the state engineer so that the water rights could be administered in accordance with
that. So why isn't that speculative harm at best?
I think the issue is very real.
If in fact there would be an intervening decision even before there would be even the possibility of some harm, why isn't that speculative?
Well, I think the issue before the court is not speculative. It's who has ability to control the allocation of CBT water. Aurora basically wants to appropriate a right to use CBT water in the exchange reach to satisfy senior intervening water rights. Northern wants to hold on to that right, preserve the right to allocate those CBT project return flows in accordance with the methods set forth in the repayment contract. I grant you that Northern must first quantify those CBT return flows in order to do that. But I don't think the issue is speculative.
Does the decree, in your view, as it currently exists, specifically permit Aurora to use CBT water in the exchange?
By virtue of operation of the exchanges, yes. There's no express language.
No, it doesn't do so specifically.
Correct.
You think that somehow operationally it does?
Operationally, it most certainly does.
And does it do that in the face of Northern quantifying that water?
It would, yes. Northern has not yet gotten to the point of quantifying the CBT return flows it is embarked on.
Maybe what you could do is explain to me how, with the current decree versus with the decree with your specific proposed restriction,
yes,
how Northern's position would be different at some time in the future should they actually quantify that water.
Well, it would be the same.
That's the only time you get into a harm situation, right, is if you quantify it.
Until Northern quantifies it, we don't know how much CBT water is there. But the issue before the court, as I see it, is authority or control over that CBT project now.
But my question is different, and I would appreciate if you could answer. How would Northern's position be different in the future, with or without this restriction in the decree?
Well, Northern's position would be the same, that CBT project water cannot be used, allocated by Aurora. It must be allocated by Northern in accordance with the repayment contract, so it would not
so
be different.
All the restriction does, in your view, is make explicit what you would argue is already implicit in the decree. Is that correct?
I don't think it's implicit, no. It makes it explicit.
So your situation in the future, with the decree as currently written, would be different from your situation in the future with the restriction in the decree? Would be disadvantaged in the future in some fashion.
Absolutely, because...
Well, explain to me how you'd be disadvantaged in the future when you quantify without restriction.
As I see it, the decree gives, by virtue of its operation, allows Aurora to appropriate that CBT water. And Northern is seeking a ruling in this case that it cannot do that. I see my time is, I have about four, I'm in 14 minutes. I have about a minute left, so I'm going to reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Excuse me, you're sharing the time. You have a total of half an hour, so you will have whatever the time is left for rebuttal when the co-counsel comes.
My name is David Hahn. Jim Noble and I will split the argument on behalf of East Cherry Creek. East Cherry Creek is a quasi-municipal corporation subdivision of the state formed pursuant to Title 32 of the Colorado statutes. This dispute arose from Aurora's application for approval of an augmentation plan, which claimed the right to all of the return flows generated by the district from effluent, which is discharged into the Aurora sewer system. Their claim is based entirely on the last sentence of paragraph 9 of an exclusion agreement. Under the terms of the exclusion agreement, the source and amount of the effluent covered by the last sentence is in dispute and will be addressed by Jim Noble. I will argue alternatively that the water court erred by failing to properly apply a provision of the exclusion statute to that last sentence, error resulting in granting summary judgment. The exclusion agreement states it does not become effective until a court order is entered excluding over 3,000 acres of developed property from the area of East Cherry Creek. It also states that the inclusion contract does not merge into the order. It's titled Exclusion Agreement. Clearly, the purpose, and in addition, it was attached as a petition to a joint petition to exclude. The intent of the agreement clearly is to comply with the special district exclusion statute. With regard to the special district exclusion statute, the power of the General Assembly is plenary under two different concepts. Number one, it's plenary concerning boundary changes of municipal corporations, case set forth in our brief. Number two, it's plenary with regard to Aurora providing service outside of the boundaries of Aurora. That's set forth in Bennett Bear Creek, which is also cited in our brief. The exclusion statute provides, pursuant to the first plenary power, that before land can be excluded from East Cherry Creek, sewer service must be provided to East Cherry Creek. That's provided in section 304.2b. The reason Aurora is agreed to serve outside of Aurora's boundary is not an exercise of municipal discretion. Aurora is acting pursuant to its statutory duty. In adding the provision for service in exchange for exclusion pursuant to the General Assembly's second plenary power, the General Assembly added section 304.2c, which mandates the terms and conditions of service to the city, to the district. The subdivision provides, in essence, that if Aurora is serving other areas outside of the city of Aurora, the service to the district must be the same as the service to the other areas. And then the statute says, if there are no, the subsection says, if there are no other areas, then the service must be based on a mutually agreeable rate and standards and conditions which are the same as the standards and conditions in Aurora. Neither Aurora nor the district can waive the public policy by contract, citing a case not set forth in our brief, Hardin versus Heritage Health Products in 98 Pacific 3rd, 478, a Court of Appeals case, which fortunately cites a Supreme Court case in 86 Colorado at 320. The Water Court granted summary judgment to Aurora based on its determination that the provision I just generally talked about did not cover the last sentence of paragraph 9. The court said the subsection only applies to the land which was excluded from the district and not the land which remains in the district, which is contrary to the language of the statute. To help establish the importance of the error of the court's ruling, we call this court's attention to paragraph 7 of the exclusion agreement, which sets out a mutually agreeable rate of $420 per million gallons, with the rate adjusted according to other costs incurred by Aurora. Therefore, the remaining case to be tried is the issue of the last sentence of paragraph 9. Does that phrase, upon which Aurora relies, come within the phrase standards and conditions applicable within Aurora, which is the provision of the statute? Or does that last phrase come within the phrase from Bennett Bear Creek, an abuse of Aurora's authority to reap a monopoly profit? The district argues that there is no reasonable relationship between sewer service and the right to reuse water not owned by Aurora.
I'm really sorry to interrupt you. I just want to make sure I'm tuned into the right sentence. So the sentence that you're referring to is the district hereby grants to the city? What?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the last sentence of paragraph.
That's the sentence that you're referring to, just that particular sentence.
That was the basis of Aurora's application. That was the basis of the court's ruling. That was the provision of the exclusion contract where the court determined the statute didn't apply.
Okay. Thank you.
Could you just repeat the story? Your argument about the rational relationship, that's not being met as a matter of law.
I said it appears to the district that there is no reasonable relationship between sewer service and the right to reuse water not owned by Aurora.
Okay, and so now getting back into that last sentence. What was your point with respect to the last sentence?
My point with regard to the last sentence is that the statute says a mutually agreeable rate, which is set forth in the contract, and then the statute says subject to standards and conditions applicable within Aurora, so that before the court can determine to grant summary judgment, there must be a determination that there are standards applicable within Aurora which meets the that particular grant. We say they do not exist, but we say really that it's an issue of fact and it's improper to grant summary judgment where there is a real issue of fact, where the issue of fact is sidestepped by the court by misreading the exclusion statute.
Is that factual affidavits to support your position?
It's Aurora's burden to establish that they have the right to the water. They rely totally on the language of the last paragraph. The court determined that there were no issues of fact. The court determined that because the statute did not apply to the last sentence, that there was no factual issue, that the court would simply interpret the last section as a matter of law and rule. We say that is incorrect. It was immediately followed by the court misreading the statute. And I think my time is up. Unless there are questions.
Good afternoon. My name is James Noble with the law firm of Riley, Carlock & Applewhite, and I'm here on behalf of East Cherry Creek Valley Water and Sanitation District as well to discuss the contract interpretation issues that were raised in ECCV's appeal in this case. In this case, we believe that the Water Court misinterpreted the 1976 exclusion agreement between the City of Aurora and DCCV because the court determined that there are no limits on Aurora's rights to recapture and reuse sewage effluent arising in the district and delivered to the Aurora system. The court did not recognize any limits based on the sources of water that were contemplated by the parties when they entered this agreement, and the court did not recognize any limits based on the express distinction in the agreement between the district and its service area.
Council, can I stop you there? Just,
sure.
I mean, just to help me with the language. Where do you find the limitations? I mean, you said there's the court improperly found no limitations, but the language seems to say the right to recapture and reuse all effluent.
Right.
Can you help me find the limitations
sure.
that you find there?
There are two different limitations that we believe. The agreement makes an express distinction between land that was within what was called the district, which is the land that was in the district as of January 1st, 1976, under paragraph 10 of the agreement. And then the agreement refers to this land, which is referred to as a service area, which was land that was authorized for ECCV to serve in the future. And in the map, which is attached to our reply brief and shown here, it demonstrates that the blue crosshatched area was the land of the district at the time, and the land within the red outline that is not crosshatched was the land of this service area. And it's our position that the agreement makes a clear distinction between land that was in the district and land that was in the service area. And the land that was, and this last sentence of paragraph 9 specifically applies to sewage arising in the district, and it leaves out the service area, whereas the remainder of the agreement refers to the district and the service area on numerous occasions.
So I guess what I had trouble with in your argument is you give district two different interpretations. I didn't really understand where that came from.
Sure. There's the district. ECCV is a district. It's a quasi-municipal corporation, and it's referred to, it's an entity. On the first page of the agreement, I believe it refers to it as a quasi-municipal corporation. But then there are other descript uses of that same word within the agreement, where they say the district is land, where the district is referred to as land as opposed to the entity. In paragraph 9 specifically, for example, refers to sewage arising within the district. Well, that has to refer to sewage arising within the land of the district as opposed to the entity. So that's why we use the term.
So you're saying that comes from the context of a particular sentence or paragraph, whatever that word is using?
That's right. And paragraph 10 of the agreement specifically describes the lands in the district as of January 1st, 1976, as opposed to the lands of the service area. So that's where we draw that distinction.
Now, what's in the record that would support your point of view that there were two different meanings to the one word district? Seems like a very unusual argument to make. We're now talking about construing a contract that was entered into, 30 years ago or something like that?
That's right. We referred to the language of the agreement itself. It was there is no extrinsic evidence with respect to this point that was referred to at the trial.
Thank you.
The second limitation that ECCV believes should be applied to this contract is that the reuse rights should be applied to the sources of water that were contemplated by the parties at the time in 1976. In 1976, it was all the parties contemplated that ECCV would have water from non-tributary wells within the district as its water supply. And that fact was stipulated to at trial. And under Colorado law, you consider the contemplation of the parties, even if an agreement is not determined to be ambiguous. Nobody at that time contemplated that 30 years later, ECCV would acquire surface water rights from many, many miles away and deliver them through a pipeline to the district. And therefore, we believe that the contract should be limited to confer those reuse rights based on the water sources that were contemplated as of 1976. I see that there's less than 1 minute remaining, which Mr. Siner reserves, so I will let him.
Good afternoon. If it may please the court, my name is Steve Sims. I'm with Brownstein Hyatt Farber Schreck. I represent the city of Aurora. With me in the courtroom today is Lisa Darling, the South Platte Basin Manager for the city of Aurora, Christine McKinney from the city attorney's office in Aurora, and my co-counsel at trial, Mr. Adam DeVoe. The case today is the last one involving the Prairie Waters Project. Aurora's project that initially will allow it to treat and reuse 10,000 acre feet of reusable effluent. This case involves the exchange and augmentation parts of the project. On the exchange issue, the key to understanding the exchange case is the threshold finding the court made at page 2 of its May 6th order concerning injury, where it found, quote, Aurora presented a prima facie showing of no injury to the court. Northern did not then and does not now assert that operating the exchanges as Aurora proposes will cause injury to the other users. The finding is important because it shows that Aurora met the non-injury standard that must be established before the water court can grant an exchange pursuant to 3792.305.3. After Aurora proved its prima facie case, the burden shifts to Northern. They have to show that they have a water right, and they have to show that water right is injured by the proposed exchange. If they do that, if they're able to satisfy that burden, the court may still grant the exchange if it can fashion terms and conditions adequate to prevent the injury. Here, Aurora proved its prima facie case, but Northern did not meet its burden in showing injury. And therefore, Northern cannot argue it was error for the water court to refuse to implement the term that they proposed because there was no injury to mitigate. Northern, based on the Thornton versus Bijou decision, argued that the general exchange law has no relevance in this case. But in the Thornton case, this court affirmed the water court's refusal to apply general exchange law only because Thornton had limited their water rights by virtue of being a CBT contract holder. Here, the opposite situation exists. Aurora does not own or divert CBT water, and therefore, without the contractual limitation of the Thornton case, the water court had to approve the exchange once it found that the exchanges did not cause injury. Throughout its argument this afternoon, Northern has stated that Aurora has used CBT water to satisfy senior intervening rights. The only support for Northern's argument was that there's CBT water in Aurora's exchange reach. The court considered Northern's position regarding the presence of CBT water in the exchange reach and rejected that argument, finding, and I quote, Aurora does not own any CBT project allotments, nor does Aurora propose to use CBT as substitute or replacement supply for the exchanges and augmentation plan. Aurora will not divert CBT water directly at the exchange 2 points. Despite this ruling, Northern continually states that the water court found that Aurora benefited by the increased exchange potential. This just isn't a fair ruling, or reading of the court's ruling. In fact, the court stated, and again I quote, Northern claims that Aurora will derive benefits from the presence of CBT return flows because the return flows increase the reach's exchange potential. However, any such benefits would be incidental if they exist at all. Though Aurora may incidentally benefit from the presence of CBT return flows in the Prairie Waters exchange reach, Aurora has no right to enforce the contracts that place the CBT water there. This quote shows that the water court was dubious about any benefit to Aurora because Aurora did not seek a decree vesting the alleged benefits.
Could you just pause there 1 second?
Sure.
So what did the court have in mind when it said it would be incidental, any benefit at all?
I think exactly that point. Because they didn't seek a decree that vested the benefits, it was completely different than the Thornton case. In the Thornton case, as you recall, Thornton actually sought a decree that allowed it to use CBT water to replace its ditch loss obligations and to perform a ditch exchange. It's incidental because without this in the decree, Northern can remove it at any point, and any benefit that there might have been can be removed. They can put a pipeline in. They can contract to allow this to be delivered at a certain headgate. They can do all those things, and Aurora can never object to that because they don't have it in their decree.
So by incidental, the court didn't have in mind something minimal or peripheral, but rather something that could be removed.
It appears to be, and Justice Coates, I think that's largely because there were almost no facts as to what the benefit would be or how much water was involved. Northern quantified the amount of water in the Big Dry to St. Vrain reach as about 7,700 acre feet, which works out to about 10 CFS on a daily basis. This is a very big river. It's a river that has 250,000 acre feet flowing it on an annual basis. So the judge may have been thinking that's just a too small amount of water to worry about, but because the facts really weren't there to sustain that, my guess is because Aurora had not saw a decree seeking to vest the water right. Northern has also argued that the Jackson Ditch part of the Thornton-Bijou case supports its argument that the court can limit extra district benefits to entities that don't own CBT contracts. Northern's wrong about this. The Jackson Ditch ruling was nothing more than a ruling that the owner of a water right must consent to the change of that water right. Justice Martinez, this is the exact point you made in the Meadow Island case. If you're changing someone's water right, they have to approve that. In this case, the water court in the Thornton-Bijou case, as far as the Jackson Ditch part, found that a part of the Jackson Ditch water supply was actually CBT water. And therefore, since it was actually CBT water, they needed Northern's approval. So this did not give Northern the authority to go out and regulate on extra district benefits that may be enjoyed by other water users. This was just good old-fashioned case law that's been out there for 70 years. In this case, neither Aurora nor the Water Court analyzed the Jackson Ditch case because no one has argued. The stipulations don't say it. There was no proof at all submitted to the court. The Water Court didn't make a finding on it. No one has argued that Aurora was either diverting CBT water or sought to change CBT water. As a result, Jackson Ditch doesn't apply. In their briefs, Northern argued that it has broad powers under 3745.134 to regulate any extra district persons that derive benefits from CBT water. In Thornton-Bijou, this court recognized that Northern has the right to make rules and regulations that implement the extra district limitations found in the Water Conservancy Act. The extra district limitations in the Water Conservancy Act are found at 3745.118.1J. What you need to understand, though, is 118.1J is not a blanket prohibition on out-of-district persons deriving benefits from project water. Instead, it's just a powers section in the Water Conservancy District Act. It gives Northern the general power to sell or lease project water. But then it limits Northern's discretion in who they can sell or lease it to. It says you can't sell or lease it to people out of the district. Therefore, any regulation that Northern promulgates to implement 118 has to be consistent with the scope of that statute as set forth in the Water Conservancy Act. And in fact, if you look at Northern's rules that they attach to the brief, this is Book 2, Rule Roman Numeral 4, that's all they did. All they did was said, you can't give it to people outside the district. Here's what the contracts have to say. Here's why we think that. It didn't even purport to regulate extra district persons that were deriving benefits from CBT water without a contract. Since nothing in 118 prohibits parties from deriving benefits without diverting CBT water or contracting with Northern, Northern can't use its 118 regulations to broadly regulate water users like Aurora. The only other issue I want to bring up in regarding to the change before I switch over to the contract issues has to do with whether or not Aurora has even benefited by this water. Please understand that the court didn't make a ruling that Aurora benefited from the water. Northern didn't submit any proof that district taxpayers are denied the use of project water. Aurora agrees that the use of project return flows is reserved for the downstream district taxpayers, those that can't take direct delivery through allocation contracts. We agree with that. We agree that that is an important part of the project. But this benefit is not quantified in time, location, or amount, or reflected by a decree assigned to any particular headgate. As a result, without the decree, pursuant to this court's ruling in Turkey Canyon Ranch versus Sirola, while the district taxpayers may enjoy a benefit, they do not have a water right that can be administered in priority or that can be injured by a competing water user. So it's not at all surprising that Northern, when the burden shifts to them, after Aurora proved their prima facie case of non-injury, why they couldn't hold up a water right and say, this water right, which benefits from the return flows that are coming down the Platte, is being injured, because no such decree exists and no amount of the return flows has been assigned to any particular headgate. I'll switch to the contract issues. First of all, throughout the brief, throughout the many arguments, this had 4 motions for summary judgment, 3 motions for reconsideration. Feels like I've been briefing this case for 2 years. But throughout this argument, ECCV has stressed that the Meadow Island case and the rules of contract construction lead to a conclusion that there are somehow limitations in the contract between ECCV and Aurora. Remember, rules of construction are not needed when the agreement is unambiguous and not in need of construction. The Waters Court spoke to the ambiguity of the 1976 contract in its final ruling when it stated, testimony offered by ECCV during the one-day trial claimed that ECCV did not contemplate the number of surface water sources it would acquire in the decades following the formation of the 1976 contract. While this may have been true, this evidence does not change the court's determinations that the terms of the 76 contract are unambiguous and that as a matter of law, the 1976 contract confers on Aurora the right to reuse any and all sewage flows ECCV delivers to it.
Counsel, can I stop you there?
Sure.
That language also drew my attention, but I'm wondering if you could just directly talk about the two different uses of the word district, because that same sentence uses district twice. But if you look at the next section, in section 10, it talks about the district or within blah, 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 the service area. So, I mean, what do you do with the fact that the contract uses the word district as distinguished from the service area?
First of all, I want you to understand some facts. And the fact is that all sewage that's delivered by ECCV to Aurora today, with two very, very small exceptions, comes from the area within the district boundaries. So if you just take the contract at its face today, it's clearly a situation where you don't even have to make the distinction. But because it was argued, the water court actually had to grapple with that too. And they looked at the third whereas in the contract on the first page. And the third whereas describes basically three different flavors of property. District property that was in the annexed areas of Aurora, district property that was in the unannexed areas, and district property or and service area. And the court, the water court said, these three areas are all determined to be part of the district. They looked at them all one and of the same. The court also made a similar conclusion when they looked at paragraph 9. In paragraph 9, it talked about the district and the service area providing sewage, and that sewage had to meet the standards for Metro. And if you take the interpretation by ECCV, the fact that it only said the district had to meet the service standards could lead to the conclusion that, gosh, that part of the sewage arising in the service area wouldn't have to meet the Metro standard. Well, that didn't make any sense, and that clearly wasn't what the parties intended. And so the court looked at that and said the best integrated ruling of all this is that district basically included all of those terms. Now in paragraph 10 is interesting, because what paragraph 10 does is paragraph 10 sets up Aurora's obligation to receive sewage from 16 sections of land that may come online in the future. Some of those were in the service area, some of those were within the 76 boundaries. I mean, really all 10 did was it just said, Aurora's not going to object, ECCV, if you bring on all the sewage, and we'll take whatever you deliver. And remember, ECCV delivers this. Even back in the days when they had service area, which they basically don't have now, they still took the flows from the service area, and ECCV took those flows and gave it to Aurora. So ECCV was always the one delivering the flows, even though they may have received it from someone else. But probably most importantly, there's absolutely no indication in any fact or in any document or in any part of the 76 contract that the parties ever contemplated that some of the sewage that was delivered Aurora could have the reuse of, and some they couldn't. I mean, the facts, the way the parties interpreted this agreement through their actions over the years would indicate that. And we argued this well in the brief. The ECCV, if they really saw this distinction, if they really saw that there's a distinction between sewage that came from the post-76 boundaries or sewage that came from water sources that weren't contemplated, why didn't they account for that? Why didn't they say, okay, Aurora, here's how much sewage we used. This part's your part to use, and this part's ours to use. There is a tremendous market, as this court's opinions would reflect all the way back to 72, of people leasing effluent for reuse, even if ECCV didn't have the ability to use it themselves. So it just doesn't make sense. ECCV in their reply brief says, well, gosh, we've been fighting about this forever, so our actions in the past really don't show anything other than that we've been fighting. And I couldn't stand here with a straight face and tell you that we haven't been fighting about it for a long time. But What I can tell you is that these arguments, the 76 boundaries arguments and the new after-acquired water source boundaries, these arguments are 2009 vintage arguments, and there's no facts to indicate that they go back. And why is this important? It's important because ECCV has argued that the intentions of the parties in making the contract back in 76 was always to exclude certain parts of water or to put limitations on it. No evidence would reflect that. ECCV argues that the 76 contract was somehow unfair. And first of all, before I get into that argument, I did want to address Mr. Hahn's arguments about the exclusion statute, because that's confusing. And that argument was made below, and the court resolved it correctly below, but it was repeated. The mistake was repeated again here. And that is that the provision 304.2b somehow set up a standard that Aurora had to provide sewer service to ECCV after the exclusion. That's not what the statute says. It says that after the exclusion, when Aurora takes part of the ECCV customers into its own system, it has to provide sewage system to those people, and ECCV takes care of themselves. The deal between Aurora and ECCV was one of convenience for ECCV. This allowed them to take 16 sections of undeveloped land and build houses on it without having to build their own sewer system. I'm not saying that Aurora treated this water, although they treat a little bit of it. Most of it was collected in these gigantic sewer interceptors and taken to Metro, but still, this is a big system that Aurora had to construct, and Aurora had to reserve capacity in the system for ECCV's build out of these 16 sections. And so it was an important benefit that they got. But the other thing he argued was 304.2c was that service in the district had to be the same as other areas. Well, those words are there. But when you look at the exclusion statute, what the statute says is that when Aurora takes in these ECCV refugees into the city, as to those people, Aurora can't discriminate. It doesn't say that it has to do a contract with ECCV and then treat ECCV exactly the same as it treats its own taxpaying citizens. So that's a misconception of the statute that we heard. But here's the importance of the exclusion statute and how this worked. The exclusion statute and the 76 contract was the agreement that the exclusion statute required. The exclusion statute says when you have overlapping districts and you wanna split the sheet and you wanna make sure there's no double taxation of those people, you can do it, but you have to make arrangements for the bonded indebtedness. You have to make arrangements for how the different customers will be served before and after. You have to lay out a plan. And that's got to be in writing. And then it has to go to a district court. And the district court has to review it. And the district court has to find that was fair. Aurora and ECCV did all of those things. And the contract that they're now claiming to be unfair, that's not supported by consideration, that contract ECCV stipulated to as fair back in 1976. They gave it to the district court, the Arapahoe County District Court, in 1976. The Arapahoe County District Court said this is fair and entered an order saying that, and no one appealed it. On their arguments about consideration that were mainly in the brief, they argued that, well, gosh, we're paying a lot more now if you give a big value for the effluent than we probably should have. And therefore, it's unfair. And we want you, as the court, to balance the benefits we got versus the burdens we're paying and come to a conclusion that the agreement's unfair. So you, and what they, although they didn't want you to actually do away with the agreement, because then they'd have to find another source for their sewage, what they really wanted you to do was to rewrite the agreement. Well, adequacy of consideration is evaluated at the time of the original bargain and does not require an exact parity of economic values. Although when you look back to 1976, when there wasn't as much reuse going on, it probably is a situation where the sewage and the effluent was looked at more as a detriment or as a waste or as a burden than it was this great economic benefit. But that's the time you look at, is in 76, not in 2008. Courts don't reevaluate consideration 34 years after the fact using 2020 hindsight. ECCV's argument concerning the after-acquired water. I wanted to get in a little bit to the Consolidated Ditches case because there was a lot of pages in the briefs where we talked about the Consolidated Ditches case. When Judge Klein looked at it, and he looked at it twice, once on the first motion for summary judgment and once on reconsideration, when he looked at it, he said the Consolidated case has no relevance to the construction of the 1976 contract. The facts just weren't the same, and they weren't. But let me give you a little bit of background on that. The Consolidated case dealt with an old agreement between Denver and a group of ditches downstream of the metro area. And what they were trying to accomplish at the time is that Denver had a lot of main stem reservoirs that they kept full, even though they're evaporating, and they're doing it essentially out of priority. So the deal they made with the downstream ditches is we'll pay back our out of priority depletions by agreeing that we will never reuse our Trans Mountain effluent. And at the time, the amount of effluent coming in, this was in 1940, and the amount of evaporation was pretty close. Well, over the years, as Denver grew, the amount of effluent became greater. But the straw that broke the camel's back as far as Denver's concerned was when they brought on the Dillon Reservoir System, because that just exploded the amount of effluent that was coming out. And they went to the court and they said, you know, that agreement we made back in 1940, we don't think it's fair to include the Dillon water that's coming through. Instead, we'll just put the Moffett Tunnel water through there. And the court agreed with them. And one of the factors they considered was whether Denver had paid way, you know, whether the interpretation was that the benefits that they were getting were static and the burdens that they were obligated to pay were ever increasing. And the court said, you know, that's a consideration that we'll look at in making this determination. Well, now ECCV wants to apply that same rule from that case to interpreting this one. But this is not the same case. This is not the same type of contract, and it's not the same type of benefit analysis. In this case, the benefit is that sewer is delivered. And as an ever-increasing amount of sewage is delivered to Aurora from ECCV, Aurora's right to reuse the effluent increases proportionally. So this isn't that the benefits are stuck here and the payment goes up here. The benefits continue to rise. Aurora reserves a part of their pipe for ECCV. And as that pipe fills up with ECCV effluent, part of the payment that Aurora gets back is the right to recapture and reuse the return flow. Hopefully this is the last time we're back in front of you on the Prairie Waters Project. It's been three cases. It's the second time we've been to the Supreme Court. Thank you for your attention today, and we would urge you to affirm the ruling of the Water Court. Thank you.
Exactly. I want to make just two points. Mr. Sim mentioned